Appreciate it. I'm Mike Allen from Politico. We're grateful to our friends at the Brookings Institution for this great and enlightening panel, President Obama at 100 Days. Had a good time listening to the morning session with my boss, John Harris of Politico, and he taught me a phrase that I didn't really realize. I guess you could call it moderator's prerogative. Harris seemed to like the phrase, my own view is. So I'll try to throw that in at appropriate intervals. We're very grateful to our partners here at the Brookings Institution. I have a buddy on Capitol Hill who said that during the Bush administration, we probably wouldn't know anything if it weren't for Henry Waxman. Well, as a reporter, I can tell you that we wouldn't know anything without the Brookings Institution. So we're grateful to their scholars and administrators who are so generous in helping us. Now, in this part of the panel, we're going to turn to the world of foreign policy, national security, which we're excited about. First, as we start, we wanted to thank Darrell West, Director of Governance Studies here. And I just wanted to congratulate Darrell and his colleagues on the launch of GovWatch, which is within brookings.edu, just went up yesterday. So day 101 for Barack Obama, day 2 for GovWatch. We'll have a day 100 event for them. But there's a lot of juicy stuff in there, collected metrics on presidential approval, presidential job performance, a little connecting of the dots, very interesting series of data points. Suggesting that for all the hoopla there is about President Obama and his standing right at this moment, that there were two other presidents that had strikingly similar, in fact, identical, in some case, metrics at this moment, and those are President Nixon and President George W. Bush. So day 100 can only tell you so much. We're excited for this panel. We're going to start off. We're just going to walk down, and each of them is going to make a brief comment about a topic that's that they're passionate about, and then we'll mix it up a little bit. We're fortunate to have with us today Tammy Wittes, who's the director of the Middle East Democracy and Development, that's MED, project at the Saban Center for Middle East Policy, which, of course, is a project of Brookings. Before that, U.S. Institute of Peace, Georgetown, and be sure to check out Dr. Wittes' book, which is Freedom's Unsteady March, America's Role in Building Arab Democracy, from here at Brookings. And I wanted to key in right away on that issue, Tammy. President Obama, throughout the campaign, very early on, going back to Iowa, promised a change in tone in our posture internationally and generally, and specifically in the Middle East. I wonder, at 100 days, if we get a sense of where that's coming, and is there even any progress yet?
Absolutely. Mike, thanks. I think you can see the change in tone beginning even with the inaugural address. And as far as the Middle East is concerned, I think there's probably no other region in the world where President Bush's departure from office was greeted with a greater sigh of relief. So President Obama was able to begin his term with respect to the Middle East and the broader Muslim world, even despite the war in Gaza, with a major advantage just by contrast with his predecessor. And he took advantage of that right away in the inaugural, speaking specifically to the Muslim world, saying that we seek a new way forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect, giving his first broadcast interview to Al Arabiya, an Arabic language satellite channel. And some may argue even that he might have gone a bit overboard in his outreach efforts to the Muslim world in these first 100 days, speaking in Turkey and so on. I think the dramatic change in tone in America's public diplomacy these past 100 days is striking. It's certainly had an impact on perceptions in the region. But most importantly, it's an easy way, in a sense, for President Obama, for his foreign policy team, to try to begin to rebuild some of the political capital he needs with foreign leaders in order to work with them and get them to do some hard work on the tough questions that we're facing. In a lot of ways, changing tone is the easy part. And the hard part is implementing a new direction in policy, which he also clearly has in mind on the Middle East peace process, for example, but implementing that new direction in the face of all those tough realities that haven't changed just because George Bush left office. The divisions in the Palestinian camp, the election of a right-wing government in Israel, the dangers of drawdown in Iraq, the challenges of engagement with Iran, all these things are unaffected by that change in tone. So all the tone does is give him maybe a little bit of a reserve of goodwill to get other states to do the work he'd like them to do on the path ahead.
Tammy Wittes, you raised the possibility the president had gone overboard. What was the general view of his holiday YouTube for Iran? And could you just tell us real quick, remind us what that was?
Well, in Iran, there is a traditional holiday marking the spring equinox called Nowruz. And he isn't the first U.S. president to release a Nowruz message to the Iranian people, but he did it on YouTube, making it more accessible and much more personal, because it was on video. And speaking to the Iranian people, referring to the Islamic Republic of Iran by name, in other words, signaling that maybe this revolutionary government that the U.S. has been at odds with for 30 years is something that we can accept de facto. But also speaking to the people of Iran and saying, you're a great nation, we have tremendous respect for your history and your achievements, and we want a new kind of relationship. From a public diplomacy perspective, it was a fantastic success. There was a lot of discussion of it in the Iranian press, in the regional press. On the Iranian government's part, the response was much more cautious and skeptical, and I think this is of a piece with their responses to the broader idea of engagement. They are taking it slow, and I think for the most part, President Obama and the administration are also taking it slow. And so there's a little bit of careful dancing going on. We'll see how it plays out.
Okay, thank you, Tammy. Bill Entholes and I have been friends for so long that when we met, he and I both had less need for a hat. So we've known each other for a while. Bill is the managing director here at the Brookings Institution, our host. We're appreciative for that. And Bill has seen it all. Immediately before this, he and I worked together when he was the director of studies and senior fellow at the German Marshall Fund of the United States, which has fascinating work in fields that we all are interested in. And before this, Bill really had his boots on inside the West Wing. He was at the White House. He was director of international economic affairs for the National Security Council and the National Economic Council. He was the chief staff person for the G8 summits in 97 and 98. Is that different than the Sherpa, or is that the same thing?
It's the coordinator for the Sherpa.
Okay. The Sherpa's Sherpa.
Exactly.
And deputy director of the White House climate change policy team, position that did not exist in the last administration. He's also with the CFR, and he remains on the board of a great organization, the Civic Education Project, which supports Western-trained social science instructors for universities in Central and Eastern Europe. And Bill, I want to pick up right away on climate change. It's one of the big three for President Obama. You're seeing more and more skepticism in the press about the outlook for dramatic climate change legislation. It seems like it always now has an asterisk with it. I wonder, how optimistic are you, and what sort of path is the administration on in this important area?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's always great to do stuff with Mike. I remember the first time I got a phone call from Mike, it was when climate change came up at a G8 summit and trying to figure out what happened and where it was going. And the same can be said now as 10 years ago. I mean, it's good that it's on the agenda. It's good that it's moving forward, but the outcome is far from clear. It's kind of like the weather itself. The first 100 days, I think, have been remarkable in how consistent President Obama has been at keeping this at the top of the agenda, in spite of growing opposition. In the election, it was something that was very easy for both him and Senator McCain to talk about in a positive sense. But the rubber meets the road when you actually have to write legislative language for things. The initial Obama budget had, Obama administration budget had over $300 billion in revenue from auctioning all emissions permits. I think it's quite clear that now that that's not going to happen in that full bore. So in the first 100 days, I would say that he gets an A for effort and a B for action, which is he keeps moving it forward, but they clearly haven't dotted all the I's, they far from dotted all the I's and crossed all the T's. In the next 100 and 200 days, there are important benchmarks to look at. Starting with 200 days, there are going to be 100 or so U.S. negotiators getting on airplanes and flying to Copenhagen to negotiate this big agreement. For 8 years, one of the great hallmarks of global displeasure with the Bush administration's unilateral approach has been the way that they torpedoed the Kyoto Agreement. And the Obama administration clearly wants to set that straight, and they keep saying that they want to pass domestic legislation before they go negotiate a treaty, which is the right thing to do. It's good for the negotiations, and it's good for domestic law. The challenge is, can they do that? And 100 days from now, we'll have a better sense of that. And here the challenge is the House and the Senate. The House, relatively speaking, green legislation is moving forward with the names Waxman at the top of it, Waxman-Markey. What the actual contours of that looks like when it comes out of the House is still to be determined. It's sort of banging around through the bumper cars of the committee process.
And is it more or less aggressive than what President Obama proposed on the campaign trail?
It's slightly less aggressive. Some of the environmental groups are starting to look at it, but it has the basic structures and features of what President Obama was looking for. It's almost all auctioning of emission permits as opposed to allocating them. And it's a rather technical thing we can go into, but what it essentially means is it'll generate more revenue for the administration if you auction all this stuff, as opposed to giving things away to power utilities and saying, you determine what the value of these things are, the ability to reduce emissions.
And that clearly makes it more saleable to the Hill.
If you allocate them,
right,
you bet.
Right.
And folks, the real question is what you can get through the Senate, but the House wants to go through this ritual to strengthen its bargaining position because the structure of the Democratic majority in the House being what it is, they can get a stronger bill than the Senate. And then it's going to come down to reconciliation, which sounds like a word of comedy, but actually if they fast-track it to reconciliation, which is not going to happen, it would be an explosive thing.
Okay. All right. And rounding out our panel today, Vonda Felbot-Brown, is the fellow in foreign policy here at Brookings. She's an adjunct professor as well at Georgetown. She's an expert on the interaction between illicit economies, military conflict. She warned me the last time that she was on a panel here that she mentioned Pakistan and provoked a fire alarm. So we'll try to do that in a little more, in a little less literal of a sense this time. Her focus is all in the news, Afghanistan, South Asia, Latin America. And in August, September, she has a new book coming out. And I'm going to pull back the curtain for you a little bit on publishing here and how sizzle even affects academia. The title for Dr. Felbot-Brown's book was Shooting Up, Illicit Economies and Military Conflicts. But now it has a slightly sizzlier title. It is Shooting Up, Counterinsurgency, and the War on Drugs. So that's how packaging occurs. And she's just back from traveling in that area. And there's a term that was unfamiliar to me that as the president began his Afghanistan policy review, became quite common internally, now shows up in the media, and that is AFPAC, regarding Afghanistan, Pakistan more holistically. I wonder what we can tell so far from the cards that President Obama has showed on this policy. And is that a new term, or is it just new sort of in the lay world?
Thanks, Mike. I think it's both a new term and a new focus. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the new administration managed to really generate momentum and raise Afghanistan and Pakistan to the priority of the agenda. To some extent, that was happening inevitably in the world as the situation was deteriorating. But clearly, the Bush administration was not focused on the region and really let the region go adrift and become massively destabilized. Without doubt, the region today is the hotbed of very serious threat to U.S. National security as well as to the security of many other countries of the world. And a real big accomplishment, I think, of the new administration, helped very much by one of our colleagues, Bruce Rydell, was to realize how Afghanistan's history has been critically influenced by regional powers, above all by Pakistan. Hence, the importance of approaching the region more broadly, Afghanistan, Pakistan, but also not forgetting the critical influence of other actors such as India. And of course, the Mumbai attacks raised that awareness once again. But I think that the administration might have been surprised is what has happened with Pakistan. The thrust of the AFPAC policy, including the white paper that was unveiled a month ago, was to look how Pakistan influences the developments, the insurgency in Afghanistan. But I think what we have seen is withering of Pakistan itself that have caught many by surprise. And I think there is now increasing recognition both among analysts and among the government officials that we cannot simply look at Pakistan through the prism of what it means for Afghanistan, that we are in acute need of a policy for Pakistan that is Pakistan-focused. Mm. And I think the same is actually true equally of Pakistani officials who are frequent, and Pakistani public, who are frequently perhaps in denial, perhaps not fully aware of the tremendous challenges and real possibility of the withering of the state that we are facing there, that is, you know, extremely disturbing.
Now, can we call Pakistan an ally?
I think in many ways we have a close interest with Pakistan, close relationship with Pakistan. The history between the two countries has been long, and we have had important interactions. I think the Pakistanis themselves are not always sure whether the United States is a reliable
right.
ally.
That's a good point. Yeah.
And I think, you know, part of the challenge is to persuade Pakistan that our interests are indeed common, that the United States and the world has no interest in seeing Pakistan dismembered, which is one of the key fears that Pakistan has, the sort of nightmare vision of being carved up between India and Afghanistan with various elements within Pakistan seceding, Baluchistan,
yeah. So it's a nightmare for them and a nightmare for us, too.
Absolutely. Yeah, and yeah. So I think that we, in fact, do have common interest. But the strategy that the Pakistani state, the Pakistani government have pursued, I think are not always in accordance with our strategies and with our view of what the appropriate strategies are. And the Bush administration essentially dealt with Pakistan through either bribery or coercion. But I think the task for the new administration, a very difficult task, but the critical task, is help the Pakistani state and the Pakistani public realign, restructure their interests so that they can really see that our interests are genuinely coherent and genuinely actually in accordance. And then that what is best for Pakistan will also be best for the regional situation and for us.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you. Now, Tammy, what is at this point, when we say the Middle East peace process, can we say that with a straight face, or do we put quotes around it? Or what sort of insight can you give into us, give us into what to look for in the news to see if something's really happening or if we can sort of tune out and go about our business?
Excellent question. I think we can say that there is a peace process of intent. Mm-hmm. There is a clear intention on the part of President Obama, mm-hmm. And one that I think we have to note, he has quite confidently but quietly insisted upon over the last weeks since the election of an Israeli government headed by a prime minister who said that the Oslo peace process was a mistake. So he is insisting on the idea of a two-state solution and negotiations toward that end. On the Arab side, we have the Arab Peace Initiative, which again is a statement of intent. If Palestinians and Israelis can come to an agreement on final status, the Arab states are prepared to recognize Israel and normalize relations. So the challenge for President Obama is to translate all of this intent into reality and to create something that is an actual process. What makes this challenge difficult, of course, is that the parties on the ground are not well situated to realize this. The Israeli government, as I said, is very reluctant to embark on a substantive process that deals with final status, although they are willing to deal with a lot of the interim issues of daily life on the ground for Palestinians. I think what's important to remember here is that for President Obama and for his team who's working this issue, the peace process is not just an end in itself, although they recognize that both morally and politically, the United States has a stake in Arab-Israeli peacemaking. But it is a means to other, in some ways, bigger ends for the United States in the Middle East. It is a means of defanging Iran and the destabilizing influence that it is having on the rest of the region. And this is an interest that Obama shares with the Arab states and with Israel. So while Benjamin Netanyahu, the new Israeli prime minister, clearly has Iran on the brain, and some have suggested that he's going to come to Washington, which he's doing in a few weeks, and tell President Obama, I can't move on the peace process until you can do something to deal with the Iranian nuclear problem, I think Obama can quite persuasively turn that around on him and say, I'm not going to be able to work effectively on the Iran issue until you help me on the peace process. Because the peace process is a means of containing Iranian influence through Hezbollah, through Hamas, in the heart of the region.
Dr. Woodis, you mentioned President Obama's team that's working this issue. Could you give us a little 101 on the envoys and what you think of the system?
You know, this was one of the big questions coming in. The appointment of Senator George Mitchell on day two of the administration to cover the Middle East peace process, Richard Holbrooke also on day two to cover Afghanistan and Pakistan, and then the long-awaited and finally announced appointment of Dennis Ross as not quite a special envoy, but a special advisor for Southwest Asia, a region that was left undefined until you and your colleagues in the media community compelled the State Department to define it, basically dealing with Iran and its regional linkages. The big question has been, and I think still is, how all these special envoys with their special duties and their special staffs would relate to the regular bureaucratic structure of the State Department that goes region by region, and whether they would be able to use that system to their advantage or whether they would, in essence, foul it up.
Well, and how they relate to the special secretary.
Yes. So far, I think, certainly on the Middle East peace process and with Senator Mitchell, everyone is marching in lockstep. Senator Mitchell's been out to the region three times, once with the secretary, twice on his own. The briefings have been coordinated both with the White House and the State Department so that when Secretary Clinton gets briefed by Mitchell, the president is also briefed by Mitchell. He is the president's envoy, but he was appointed at the State Department formally by the secretary. So this has all been very carefully managed to ensure that those in the region hearing from the special envoy are in no doubt that this is a unified message. I think that's very important. On the other two, I think the jury is still out.
So I'm going to change what I was going to say, that you sound skeptical, but you think it's not a crazy system. Maybe you do think it is somewhat crazy.
I suppose in an ideal world, the regional bureaus would be able to put forward powerful diplomacy on behalf of the U.S. government that would persuade foreign leaders. But in practice, foreign leaders, and especially allies, want to know that the person they're speaking to speaks for the president, not just for the State Department.
Right.
So I think that there is really an advantage to having somebody as a special envoy who is clearly designated as the president's surrogate. Mm-hmm. And how you manage the details of that is the question.
Okay. Now, Dr. Woodis, this is maybe a better question. That is, what could you tell us what it is about this administration, this West Wing, that produced this system? Why did this emerge?
I'm not sure I do have good insight on that, but for the obvious answer, which is that there were a lot of very experienced, talented, and politically powerful personalities. In many ways, this question isn't really about the special envoys. It's about the relationship between the secretary and the president, two presidential rivals. And I think that in practice, certainly on Middle East issues, which are very high stakes and which are occupying a lot of attention on the part of the new administration, they're working very well together. And the secretary does not seem to feel the need to put herself forward as an alternative voice.
Interesting. Very interesting. All right. Special panelist, special managing director, Bill M. Poles. You mentioned...
We have a special envoy on climate change, too, by the way.
Who is that?
Todd Stern.
And there's a climate czar, right?
And there's a climate czar, too.
How is Carol Browner doing?
Climate czar Browner, I guess she should go by, is putting a team together. And I think trying to figure out the lay of the land on the Hill. She has, for instance, not been as public as Special Envoy Stern. Special Envoy Stern went with Secretary Clinton on her first trip to Asia. There was just a meeting here in Washington that Secretary Clinton opened, but that Todd Stern ran, which was a meeting of the major emitters in the climate world. And by all accounts, it was a pretty successful meeting. Even with a very unclear legislative future in the United States, the initial steps from the administration had been very well received overseas. And people are lining up to try to, they know that even in the best case scenario, Waxman-Markey goes through and the Senate wraps its arms around it, it's still a lower level of ambition than is going to be the case in Europe. And most people seem pretty comfortable with that. What they're concerned about is how much lower the level of ambition goes when it rattles through the system. And that's Carol Browner's problem. And that's the thing that she's trying to suss out right now. I think if it depends who you listen to on how she's doing. Many in industry think, oh, she just let Waxman and Congress write this thing. And the it's similar to the critiques of the stimulus plan,
right.
That the administration took a step back and let Congress come in and write it. Mm-hmm. I think in retrospect, what could be said about the stimulus plan was the urgency of now took over, led to the expression, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And I think that that's what she's doing. The real question and the way to assess her success is how she games the Senate side of things. Arlen Specter becoming a Democrat helps this much on climate change. They have to get to 60 votes, and it's going to be some combination of Democrats and Republicans, no matter what they do. Mm-hmm. There are not 60 Democrats that will support an allocation climate change bill. There are going to be just a few that are against. And there's no clear champion yet for the bill. On health care, there's a clear champion for the bill, Max Baucus. There's no clear champion yet on climate change, except for people either who are discredited, Joe Lieberman, or who are so incredibly green that they're simply an echo of what happened in the House, and so won't be seen as credible, Barbara Boxer, maybe John Kerry. And the question is, who emerges on the Senate side, and how does Carol Browner pull that person into the process and make sure the administration gets what it needs to hand over to Todd Stern to take with them to Copenhagen?
Bill Enthos, you probably know Todd Stern quite well from the Clinton administration.
Todd and I have co-authored a few articles since then and worked together pretty closely.
Okay, tell us his mindset and the approach that we can see him taking so far.
Well, I think he first, his mindset is good in the sense that he knows how difficult this challenge is. Former House Majority Leader Dick Gephardt has described this as the most complicated political transaction in the history of mankind. So Todd has that like burden on his shoulders. Because remember, it's not just crazy domestic politics in the United States, it's also crazy domestic politics in 20 some odd European countries, all negotiating with one another for a common European position. And then, oh yeah, there's the fact that there's big developing countries that really don't have to do anything on this. They're not obligated in any way,
including
under the framework of Kyoto, including China and India, most importantly, and the rest are all sort of rounding errors. And so Todd is, his mindset is, I need to pay attention to three or four big things. I have to pay attention to the broad framework of the negotiation. I have to pay attention to the fact that some people in Capitol Hill are going to pay quite close attention to the fact that India and China don't have to do anything. And for competitiveness reasons, we need them to be engaged in solving this problem. So in addition to the formal UN negotiation, he's also breaking it down into the 15 or 20 or so negotiators that matter. So there's 140 people in the UN. There's 15 or 20. We called for 8 in our article, calling for an E8. I think he's a realist and knows that there's probably another 7 that have to be part of the conversation. So he's brought them in. And there's this group of 15 to 19 major emitters. And then there's the E2, the U.S. and China, and how do you deal with that special relationship? And he's spending a lot of time and doing a lot of conversations thinking about that and what that, and obviously having gone to China with Secretary Clinton on her first trip, it was his first trip as well. He knows that that's a big part of the conversation.
And you, when you were referring to the upcoming climate conference, you made it clear that it's your view that the United States is better to have legislation in hand. Now, there are some climate specialists who have posited to me, and this is not the Obama administration view, their view is the opposite, but some climate people will tell you that it is better to have no law than a weak law on the theory that we're going to be stuck with this, that we only do something this big for like 10 years, where the Obama view is much more, we'll sign what we can get. What of the view that a weak bill would be worse than no bill?
Well, it kind of depends how weak. I mean, I think if it's so weak that the United States is discredited going into the negotiations, particularly...
No, let's make it harder. Let's say it's not. Let's say that it's something that domestically with a straight face is being called energy climate change legislation, but it bears, it doesn't have a real cap and trade, doesn't have a real carbon tax, doesn't bear that much relationship to the sort of robustness of what the president proposed on the campaign trail.
I think the president, if he has that situation, knowing where his own personal ambition is, both middle term, where our emissions are at in 2020, and long term, where they are in 2050, which has always been, I'm not speaking for the administration, speaking for myself, this is a long term game. We have to get to someplace in the next 45 years. And knowing where the president's convictions are about that, he said it on election night when he was elected. He said it in the weeks after the election. It was his first public statement. He said it on Inauguration Day. He has consistently said energy, healthcare, and education. And every time he says energy, he says climate change. So clearly a top priority, clearly wants to go there. I think if the legislation were so bad that he walked away from it and said, I'm going to be here for 4 years, and I'm going to bring you back solid legislation. Let's work on a framework. And maybe let's, I'm definitely not speaking for the administration and haven't spoken with him about this. Mm-hmm. I think people should be thinking about plan B, yeah. Right? What is the plan B? And I think coming with a credible first set of steps on the challenge, then there are a bunch of different things you can do here. Some are technical, some are symbolic, but there are things that the United States can do that demonstrates that we're still in this game and we're going to be for the 4 years of my first term and the 4 years after in my second term. That's if I were President Obama. I would say that.
All right, that's good insight there. Now, Vonda Felbaugh-Brown, what do you think that the impact will be on U.S.-Mexican relations of this apparent pandemic that's resulting from the H1N1 flu virus?
Depends on what both administrations make of it. Mm-hmm. I think that the danger of the pandemic provides an opportunity for strengthening the bilateral relationship, for showing to Mexico that we are not simply seeing them through the prism of counter-narcotics and the violence related to the drug trade there. And this is clearly something that has very much been a concern for the Calderon administration. The end-of-year assessment, for example, by Pentagon that Mexico could become a failing state was deeply troubling to the Mexican government and to the political scene there, also because of the legislative elections coming up in July. And at the same time, the really extraordinary level of violence that is taking place in Mexico in relationship to the drug trade has become of deep concern to the U.S. Public and to the Congress because of the very close relationships between Mexico and the U.S., flow of people and goods, and the possibility that crime will spill over into border communities.
Now, and especially on progressive blogs, I think there's been the idea that the spillover that's occurred to date has been overstated in the media. Is that your sense, or is that a future threat, or is that threat here?
I would argue that to some extent the reporting has probably generated an atmosphere of greater panic than there needs to be. That said, there is certainly the potential that violence will become more present on the U.S. side, and there already are signs that some forms of violence have become intensified that are very much related to the cartels. We have, for example, seen specialized kidnappings that have increased vastly. We have seen increased exploitation on the part of the cartels of illegal immigrants or people who have illegal immigrants as relatives. So it has not been affecting necessarily the general public in the way it's been reporting. You know, there is no danger going to Phoenix, or there is no danger going to Dallas or El Paso.
Right.
But certainly the crime activity has been up. And I think it's only prudent and wise to take measures that will allow the United States to be positioned to stem crime, both the specialized crime that is affecting victims that are frequently not citizens and hence are unique victims, but nonetheless we have responsibility toward them also to protect them. And also should this spill over into crime that can affect the public in a more robust way. So I think there is no place for complacency, but this also should not generate sort of overreaction and massive panic that our southern border has become a battlefield.
Right.
Mike, one broader point I think is worth making when you raise the issue of Mexico and bilateral relations and whether this is an opportunity or a crisis. You know, there was a comment made in the first panel about the number of issues on which President Obama has ambitious plans that he is pushing forward, and a question about overstretch. And on foreign policy, too, I think we see this president coming in and swinging for the fences on a series of major issues. And, you know, there are two downsides to the strategy. The upside is he's tremendously popular. He has a reserve of global goodwill. He's in his first year. If you can't do this stuff now, when can you do it? The potential downsides, though, are number one, that there are going to be some issues that are going to fall off the side of the table because you just have so many big things on your plate. Immigration reform is a great example of this.
Can anybody read between? Did anybody by chance see him last night on that? Mm-hmm. Can you help us read between the lines of that?
Well, I think that. You know, to some extent, this goes back to what Tammy said before. He has a huge political capital, but he's still facing very serious problems.
No, but what did he say last night, as you remember it? Like, it was clear to me he raised the issue of immigration, said that he was going to push it this year, but I felt like at the same time he said, well, but I don't expect it to pass. Was that?
Well, I wanted to get to it. So I think he has the intent and he has the ambition to work toward it. At the same time, he is recognizing that there are very serious domestic constraints on issues relating to Mexico, not just immigration, but immigration being paramount. But, for example, the gun control that the Mexicans would really like us to say. One of the big things, in my view, very important things that the administration has consistently told Mexico is that we share responsibility for the violence and that we understand that we share also responsibility for dealing with immigration. But at the same time, the makeup in Congress is such that these issues are difficult to pass. And he, for example, could not deliver on promising to reinstall the ban on assault weapons that the Mexicans would really love to see. Okay. And the same goes for immigration.
Okay. So, excuse me, Dr. Woodis, you were talking about issues falling off the table. You mentioned immigration.
Right. And, you know, potentially cap and trade is going to be one of those things. In other words, you push on a wide range of things. If you get pushback, maybe you set that one aside. So that's one consequence of the swing for the fences strategy. But the other consequence is that you actually have very little political slack for the unanticipated crisis. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we don't know if swine flu is really going to end up being that kind of crisis, but there may well be other things.
There's
not a lot of excess capacity politically and in terms of time and attention.
Well,
but this is where I think the special envoys and the czars can be very helpful in a couple regards. One is a big part of it is the brand name quality of these individuals, Carol Browner, Richard Holbrook, George Mitchell. That opens doors with the media, with members of Congress. And one of the hardest things that you have when the oxygen's being sucked out of the room from big stuff and people are stretched thin is the White House getting meetings with influential people, whether they're internationally or members of Congress or the media. And the fact that you've got some brand name people in those places that can do that is a very helpful thing.
That's very interesting.
the challenge is when you've got those outsized personalities all trying to come back into a West Wing to get decision making. It's like trying to land a number of airplanes in a window, in a weather window, when you've got storms in the morning and storms in the afternoon, and the planes are backed up. That's the challenge you have, is sort of a gridlock in a West Wing trying to get too much stuff done at one time.
Well, one thing I would like to come back on, in many ways, Mexico was the unanticipated crisis. I mean, the agenda was extremely crowded. It became more crowded in fall, but Mexico was nowhere at the top of the agenda. And all of a sudden, the focus on the violence that was not new but really captured attention of the U.S. Congress as well as media became the unanticipated crisis. And I argue that the administration responded well and responded really well without going through the route of a special envoy. They tapped effective people and I think said effective things. Now, having the special envoys on lots of issues gave them the possibility of acting very rapidly on issues that were burning very quickly without having to wait through confirmations. And at some point, this needs to be aligned with regular policy, with regular decision-making processes. And one of the big things that President Obama campaigned on, as well as Secretary Clinton, was strengthening of the institutions of the State Department of Aid. And while there are real advantages and great effectiveness coming from using the special envoys, this, I don't think, should take place at the expense of neglecting the withering of these two institutions.
And we still have no director for USAID.
Right, well, I mean, again, this is the plus minus of the special envoys. The special envoys, they made a choice to not have these people confirmed. And that's a good thing because you can get them right in and get them working. And, you know, administrator of USAID or any of these agencies requires going through that process, and it's not happening. What's fascinating to me, Mike, we've gone on for how long now, we haven't mentioned the global economic crisis. And we haven't mentioned the fact that there are still unconfirmed assistant secretaries, let alone administrators, for all
Iraq.
Of these regions. And we haven't mentioned Iraq. And we have unconfirmed ambassadors for all of these places.
All right, well, give us something quick on the global economic crisis, and then we're going to bring you all into this conversation.
Well, the only thing that I'd say about it is, I'd say two things. One is, if you're waiting for another shoe to drop, think about any country out there that might already be on a margin of either political or economic crisis, and the margin just got a whole lot thinner as a result of the crisis.
And what would be on our watch list?
Well, I mean, we just look at all the various weak states that we've looked at in the past, and they're all much weaker. So you can go through Africa, you can go through South America, you can go through Southeast
Asia.
Pakistan.
Being, right.
Or if you really want the perfect storm, a place like Yemen, where you have growing al-Qaeda presence on top of everything else.
Oh, and Somalia. Not that they are plugged into the global economy other
right.
than the illegal one, but
right.
the next terrorism nightmare.
Okay, who has a question to join our crossfire here? Go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much.
And sir, if you please say your name and if you wish your affiliation.
Sure. I hope that my name and the question won't start a fire alarm. My name is Mohammed Javad Khan, and I am a doctoral candidate and also a research analyst in Pakistan Embassy. Mm-hmm. My question is to Ms. Brown, and I think once you were asked by Mr. Allen about the problems of aligning Pakistan, U.S. as an ally or otherwise, in light of what has happened in the very recent past, and also once we go back to history, as you very rightly said, there is a need which has been identified by this administration of policy being AFPAC, and some analysts say that it's becoming PAC-AF now, realizing that the focus has to be somewhere else. In view of what has happened so far in 100 days and the forthcoming events and on the 6th of May, both the presidents are coming here from Pakistan and Afghanistan. There is talk going on about the trade, about the trust deficit, and also the question of that: are we asking too much from Pakistan to handle being a new democracy and all that the country and its people have faced internally? a lot of shift has taken place within the people from Northwest Frontier Province, Fata, Balochistan, moving down south.
Okay.
My question is, how can we address the trust deficit between the two countries? Thank you.
Well, that is indeed the challenge for the administration. I would argue that the first part of it needs to be a realization in Pakistan that we are not, in fact, asking Pakistan too much. That the crisis that Pakistan is facing is indeed a crisis for Pakistan itself. That the threat of terrorism, the emergence of Tehrik-i-Taliban, Maulana Fazlallah groups, poses a very serious threat to Pakistan. And that it is in Pakistan's own interest, vital interest, to take on these challenges, which is indeed what would be also very much in alignment of what the United States is hoping. I think we should have a very serious dialogue about the means of tackling those challenges, in what way we can best assist Pakistan. The difficulties that our reliance on predator bombings poses for Pakistan and the sustainability as well as side effects of this policy. I think that's a very appropriate dialogue to have about how best we can help with helping Pakistan address the broader socioeconomic issues that in many ways are providing breeding ground and an encouraging environment for the various jihadi groups. I also think it's a good thing that indeed President Zardari and President Karzai are coming next week. This is not the first meeting they'll have. And there are opportunities for building on trilateral relationships between the three countries and thinking about what other actors need to be brought to that table or some other tables. And I'm thinking here about China, India, Saudi Arabia, Russia, Iran, or a host of actors that can potentially break away from very narrow and potentially difficult bilateral relationship to presenting a broader view of regional security that in some ways might reassure the fears that some of the countries have and yet remove some of the difficulties on moving on the bilateral relations.
Okay, somebody close to the microphone. This is your chance. Who in this neighborhood? Ma'am, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Kara Fontenot. I'm a doctoral student at University of Maryland in the English department. Hi. I was torn on whether to ask my question to the last panel or this one because I'm trying to make connections between the domestic and global economies. But I thought, Mr. Anthelis, you kind of provided an opening for this. I'm wondering, what is the connection between domestic unemployment and the use of foreign labor by U.S. companies? And I'm wondering if large U.S. corporations are prioritizing larger profits to the detriment of the U.S. working class, and whether sending jobs outside the country ultimately is better or worse for the national economy with respect to the effect that it has on the global economy. Thank you.
Quite a question list there, and I would attest, say tying it back to something like global warming, which trying to do climate change legislation in the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression raises those exact set of challenges, and how are we going to act if the Chinese don't act in fear that American multinationals will seek to set up shop in China where they don't face the same energy costs, and thereby employ workers in China and further hurt workers in the United States. It's a really hard set of questions. And the protectionist impulse will be a genuine and protective one of American workers as opposed to trying to be hostile towards others, and it's inevitable. I think the challenge in the crisis is that all countries don't do it to one another, and it becomes a circular firing squad because we employ a lot of people here based on things that we sell to other countries. And if they stop buying our stuff because we're not buying their stuff or because they're employing more people overseas, it could become a vicious cycle rather than a virtuous circle. And that's the fine line that the administration and in working with the Congress is going to have to walk.
Good question, sir. Or Matt, we'll grab you real quick.
I was wondering whether you thought there would be increased significance to the Somali pirate situation and whether there would be another boarding of an American ship and what would happen?
You could pass that to that man.
I don't think the issue is going to go away as long as Somalia exists in the state of collapse that it has existed. Now, that said, Somalia has existed in a state of collapse for 25-something years, and the piracy issue has only become very imminent there over the past few years. We have, the United States as well as the international community has moved significant assets. One of the very interesting things is that China has deployed to the region its navy. It's a break with Chinese traditional pattern, which I think shows both the significance they place on protecting the trade route as well as their recognition of their sense in their place in the international community. I think that you know there are always possibilities that another U.S. ship will be attacked. There are only so many things that international interdiction can accomplish, and as long as the underlying economic collapse and governance collapse of the country is not resolved, the problem will exist there, and we can sort of tighten the nets, not the fishing nets that the pirates at some point were after, but the international interdiction nets, but there will always be opportunities. And so then we need to react with the means possible, which is to beef up our security as much as possible, the shipping security, as well as, in my view, though, encourage the transitional government that's taking place there, that is taking, facing an enormous challenge in the jihadi group Shabab, but that nonetheless has the potential to reach out across clans, across various actors to a bit stabilize the country. But much of the piracy is also centered in Puntland, which was the part of Somalia that's been most stable and that has had most functional vestiges of governance and economy.
And so it sounds like you don't see prospects for a strong central government. Like, what would it take? Or, like, will there ever be one? Or
I would not want to condemn Somalia to arguing that they can never have a strong central government. And we have to remember that under the ICU 2 years back, they had the degree of governance they have not achieved.
And what's the ICU?
That was the Islamic Courts Union, which was a pan-Islamist grouping that tapped across various tribes and was really able for the first time to deliver governance and security. Now, it generated a lot of fears for the United States because of connections of the one wing of that group that says now al-Shabaab to al-Qaeda and Islamist connections. And our government at the time took the decision that it was better to encourage Ethiopia to topple the government than have the ICU around the country. Now, the consequence of that is the utter chaos once again and much more limited prospects of stabilization, as well as, I would argue, much stronger, much more virulent jihadi pro-Al-Qaeda group, Al-Shabaab, than we saw in 2006.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Tomislav Lendić, Fulbright Scholar at Georgetown from Croatia. My question is about U.S.-Russia relations. Actually, do you think that there is a future for U.S. defense missile shield in Czech Republic and Poland?
John Paul?
Well, I guess the first point I would make is that I'm not sure it's clear that there's a viable defense missile shield. So we can talk about deployment when we have a system that's effective. But I think what became increasingly clear over the period of the transition and over these first 100 days is that President Obama wants to put relations with Russia into a much broader context. And how he fits the pieces together, in other words, the pieces related to democratization in the former Soviet bloc, the pieces related to Iran and Russia's involvement with proliferation risks, the pieces related to integrating Russia more firmly into a stable security architecture for Europe. How these pieces all fit together, I think, is still not clear. But painting on a broader canvas is the theme that they've articulated so far. And, part of how this is going to work out is up to the Russians. And I'm not sure that we're at the stage yet where we can really judge the possibilities. But
I think an important break from the Bush years is clear prioritization of what the key U.S.-Russia relations are, and viewing the missile deployment and the silo, the radar and the interceptors in the Czech Republic and Poland through that prism, as well as recognizing that why destabilize the important strategic relationship, the key issues on nuclear reductions on Iran, in a system that is still very much in the drawing phase rather than in actual existence. And in some ways, this is being also welcomed by the two host countries. The mood in Czech Republic is at best very ambivalent, possibly hostile, and the governments were pushing the agenda through pretty much against the will of the public. In Poland, there has been more support and more of a sense that we cannot back down against Russia, that we need to stand firmly to Russia. But I think that the administration is appropriately recalibrating what the key issues with Russia are and how, if we can make progress on these key issues, we might have a more fruitful dialogue about how Russia can become integrated into some interceptor system, whether some radars could be based in Russia in ways that assuage Russia's fears that its own arsenal could be threatened and that the strategic parity and the cornerstone of the nuclear of the nuclear approach since the mid-60s won't be destabilized.
You know, Mike, one thing that I think this question really draws out that's quite interesting, and in the long history of American foreign policy, there's been the discussion of the debates between realism and idealism, between a devotion to democratic principles guiding foreign policy and pure power politics. And I think the Obama administration is sort of charting a middle course. What you see at these various, the G20 meetings that have happened in the emergence of G20 is the Obama administration, on the one hand, coming back from the Bush unilateralism, but also the idealism of democracy promotion, and dialing that back both to multilateralism, but paying attention to the great powers at the same time, China. Secretary Clinton going to China and saying, we're not going to let an empty discussion about human rights get in the way of doing business. No. Russia. In engaging the Russians, not either demonizing them as a non-democracy, nor putting them high on a pedestal, but saying, we have important issues to work on, let's reset the relationship. And you're seeing them going from big player to big player doing that kind of thing.
And that's very much driven by the recognition that the Bush years of simply trying to control or persuade these great powers has not worked. That there are limits to our power, that we might be very powerful, but we are not omnipotent, and we are not omniscient either. And that for many of these issues, the cooperations of the great powers and emerging powers like Brazil, that we have not mentioned at all, is vital. And that it needs to lead us to reassessing our role in the world as a leading nation, but as a nation that's part of a multilateral process, of a multilateral system, that possibly can be moving towards some sort of international community, if not international society. And that's the part of the idealism element the new administration, as well as realism, because it recognizes that there are limits to our power, as there are limits to the power of other countries.
Lunchtime, we're going to do a panel on topics we haven't mentioned. Bill and Tholes, I was surprised by those comments by Senator Clinton about China and human rights, and I wonder if we need to worry about whether our need for them to buy debt will affect other parts of the relationship, or is that inevitable?
It already affects those parts.
First of
all,
did you share my surprise?
What was surprising to me about it was her as the conveyor of that message.
Interesting.
And how effective it ended up being. If you recall back to the Clinton administration, one of her first steps on the world stage as First Lady was to go to China and to speak at an international women's conference on the importance of women empowerment mm-hmm. and women human mm-hmm. rights. So her first act as Secretary of State, the irony of going there and making a realist statement. And I think part of that was her credibility on these issues was fairly well established. She was not Jean Kirkpatrick. She was not Madeleine Albright in that she hadn't made a case, a career for herself as a champion of human rights. But she had made some case, so she wasn't entirely vulnerable. And as a result, I think she was pretty effective. It went a little bit against type. It got some attention, but not nearly the blowback that I would have expected.
Does it worry you at all?
It doesn't worry me that, and coming back to the point on the debt, it doesn't worry me that much because if I thought that the United States needed China to buy our debt was greater than their need to buy our debt, I would be worried.
Great point.
They're going to be not just buying our debt, but investing more in the United States, maybe sometime too much so. You remember back in the late 1980s, early 1990s, when Japan was quite strong because of its export growth, they had all this money and they didn't know what to do with it. Mm-hmm. And what did they do? They not only bought American debt, they bought Rockefeller Center in New York. I think you're going to see China doing a lot of stuff like that. They have to spend money someplace. The United States is still a place for productive investment over the long term, whether it's the securitization of our debt or real property or real businesses in the United States.
Can I make one related point, which is that I think both with China and with some of the other statements that that the Secretary made with respect to human rights that troubled some people in the democracy and human rights community, the fact that the Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor Bureau at the State Department still doesn't have anyone designated as an assistant secretary. The NSC post on democracy is still empty. There are a lot of people who are concerned about what this means. And I think getting back to the point I made at the outset, there's a case to be made for initially going to important global powers, going to important international partners and saying, look, we don't want a lot of irritants in the relationship right now. We want to work with you. And kind of setting that stuff a little bit to the side. That is good to build up that reserve of capital. You don't want to go too far in that direction, and you don't want to keep doing that for too long, because this is the United States of America. We always have had an idealist stream in our foreign policy, and one way or another, events in the world are going to compel us to respond to that call. So if they walk too far down that road, they're going to have to come back in a way that is awkward and difficult. I was a little surprised by those statements on China and other indications on human rights and democracy. I'm not troubled yet, but I would want to see them start around now to start laying down the markers on human rights and democracy issues with large powers and small.
Okay. Now, if we do another jump ball, how worried are any of you about backsliding in Iraq, that as the president proceeds with his withdrawal timetable, that there'll be some type of implosion or increased violence?
Yeah. First I would say we've had a troubling couple of weeks, and I think we have to acknowledge that. But I'm not sure that we should read too much into it at this point. What we had a couple of years ago was a situation in which acts of mass violence created a self-perpetuating dynamic between sectarian communities. There were a lot of arms and a lot of militias that were difficult to control. We're not in that situation today. The central government has exercised pretty effective control over the more militant Shia militias, has co-opted a number of them, has fought battles against some of the others. The Sons of Iraq, the Sunni insurgents, are right now on the government payroll. They may not have permanent government jobs, though, and that is a potential trouble spot down the road. But I don't see the ingredients right now for the violence that we've seen the last 2 weeks to spiral up into another civil war. But this violence does remind us of the fragility of the situation in Iraq. And, there's been a lot of discussion, if President Obama can't get the economy going again, nothing else he wants to do on domestic policy is going to matter. I would argue that Iraq plays that role on foreign policy. There are a lot of things he not only wants but needs to do in AFPAC, for example, or on the Middle East peace process, or in dealing with Iran, if he gets sucked into a situation where the drawdown in Iraq cannot go forward because the situation on the ground is too volatile to allow for it, that is going to wrap the administration in knots on a whole set of other foreign policy challenges.
Yeah, and there just simply aren't the troops, right, to do Afghanistan as well, right?
Correct. But, you know, even the troops that we are sending to Afghanistan, the boost of 17,000 troops more plus 4,000 more military advisors, in my view, don't bring the necessary troop density.
You would have at least 10,000 more?
Yes. Our Afghanistan policy is very much, and I would argue our Afghanistan-Pakistan policy, because stabilization of Afghanistan has critical repercussions for Pakistan, not just vice versa, is very much held hostage to Iraq, as it has been, you know, during the Bush years. I agree with Tammy that the central government in Iraq is stronger. I am worried about the lack of political reconciliation, the genuine lack of political reconciliation, and the mainly transactional relationship that the Sunni militias, albeit under tremendous military pressure at the time, as well as resentment and al-Qaeda in Iraq, entered into first with the U.S. and then through the U.S. with the government. But not the genuine sense of reconciliation that this is our country and we are going to live in this manner together, operating under these principles. And what also worries me then is trying to bring this very transactional monetary model into Afghanistan and trying to develop similar militias or in Afghanistan and peel the tribes off in Afghanistan precisely for this transactional relationship of fighting against the Taliban. And to some extent, the pressure to do that is a recognition of the real lack of troop density that we have, that NATO has, that the U.S. has, and the difficulties that are ahead in increasing the Afghan National Army. There's a long saying that you cannot buy an Afghan, but you can rent one. And I think we are slipping into that mode. But this notion that we are just going to rent them, I think in no way connects with the aspirations of the people and gives them hope that their elemental economic, social, and security needs will be addressed in a stable way.
Okay, I'm about to get the hook. Do we have one more question from our guests that we'll bring in here,
I could do a
Bill?
Quick comment on this, which Please is the other great phrase that I used to love about, they used to say about Jordan, the king of Jordan was just here, is that it's between Iraq and a hard place, right, between there and the Israeli-Palestinian crisis. And you could say the same about Iran being between Iraq and a hard place of AFPAC. but the thing about Iraq is it's between Iran and a hard place. It was no accident that not only Secretary Clinton, but our former colleague here, her deputy secretary, Jim Steinberg, went with her to Iraq last week. And they went together. And the secretary and the deputy secretary, is one of these sort of minor things that people don't often pay attention to. They rarely travel together. The fact that they traveled together sent a very important signal of the importance. And one of the reasons is, Jim is the coordinator of the special envoys. That's what his day job is. And he's there because he knows that what happens in Iraq affects the Middle East peace process, it affects Iran, and as a result of that, what's going on in AFPAC and with the soldiers as well. So the critical nature of Iraq is not just what's happening on the ground, but it's a central piece to a very complicated puzzle.
Okay. My parking meter has expired. I'm going to cheat by three sentences. I'm going to thank all of you and ask you to give me one sentence of something that we don't know, that you're still looking for, about President Obama and his view of America and the world, his view of American power. Like, what should we still be looking for? What are the clues that you're looking for as you pursue your contacts in government and follow the news?
We've heard a lot from both the President and the Secretary of State about the need to beef up two of the three D's of U.S. foreign policy. In other words, not just defense, but diplomacy and development. Again, the intent is there. I want to see if the investment is there.
Okay. And you stuck to the bargain. Thank you very much, Bill and Tholes.
Is President Obama willing to take losses in the House and maybe even in the Senate or less wins than he might otherwise get in the midterm elections in order to accomplish some very big things in the middle of this economic crisis, like climate change and other things?
Now, you're teasing me now. Like, what would be an example of that?
you know, how hard is he going to make people walk on climate change legislation in order to get something big in this first term? Or is he willing to wait past a midterm election where maybe the economy recovers, he hasn't forced people to walk the plank?
And tell us what you mean by walk the plank.
You know, are you going to force a coal state senator to vote in favor of something so that you're giving a robust signal internationally in the climate negotiations? Are you willing to take a pass and let the economy recover in the next 2 years, cash out at the in the midterm elections, and then be empowered in the second half of your term?
Dr. Felbaugh Brown, an unknown.
Will he and his team have the capacity to look beyond the burning crises, the extraordinary amount of burning crises, and look at neglected issues that have always fallen by the wayside and perhaps come us to haunt, and as well as invest in developing new international structure, new international institutions in the economic realm, in the climate change realm, in the security realm? Or will they become prisoners of all the crises they had inherited?
I want to thank you very much for being a great audience.
By the way, that requires people walking the plank.
go back to the pirates.
As well as investing in the other 2Ds.
That's right.
I want to thank you very much for being here. I want to thank our host at Brookings Institution, Governance Studies. Thank you very much for these very insightful, candid, engaging panelists, Tammy Wittes, Bill Antholis, Vonda Felbaugh Brown. Thank you very much for a great presentation, and thank you guys.